Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for June 22nd, 2009, and on this week's episode, Ann Nicholson-Weber interviews Joshua Schmidt and Jan Trannan from A Minister's Wife. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready and let's talk theater.
This is Ann Nicholson-Weber, and you're listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. This week, our topic is the new musical being premiered at Writers Theater called A Minister's Wife. And with me to talk about it are Josh Schmidt, who's the composer, and Jan Trannan, who is the lyricist. Thanks so much for coming out on a Sunday. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Thank you. We could start, I think, by just if you could tell me where this project began and how the two of you became involved with it. Just a little background. Josh?
This project is the brainchild of artistic director Michael Halberstam. It has its origins in, first, I would say, his production of Candida in 1997, which was the first time that he directed it, and it was here at the bookstore space.
We should explain that the musical is essentially an adaptation of a George Bernard Shaw play called Candida.
And he directed that play then, and then he directed it in New York at the Jean Cocteau, rest in peace. And I was invited to do the incidental score to it. There isn't any sound design per se in that show. Except for tops and bottoms of acts, with the understanding that this could be used as potential musical material to develop into a full-blown music theater piece. Right around that time, I think Jan and I met for the first time in Michael's office, and that was the start of it. I was sort of knee-deep in working on an adaptation of Elmer Rice's The Adding Machine over at Next. So we really didn't start in earnest working together as Jan and I working together on it until the summer of 2007, which was after the premiere in Evanston, the summer after the premiere.
Of Adding Machine. Right, at Next Theater.
But then the next 2 years have been a relatively intense process of florid emails, trips to Milwaukee, for me, to Chicago and to New York, and it's been fun, right?
So you had an affiliation with writers because you had done sound design.
Well, my main job in life is I am a composer and sound designer, incidental music or sound effects or sound systems and such for theaters all across the country, here, New York, Milwaukee, Houston, all over the place.
Was Adding Machine your first full musical?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is your second.
This is the second.
And Jan, what was your affiliation? How did you get brought into this project?
Well, I had written a musical called Crazy Mary that had a few productions, and one of them was directed by Michael Halberstam. So he had decided to put me together with Josh on this project years before he actually did it. Uh-huh. He had been talking about it. So it was just my good fortune that this happened right before The Adding Machine. And
which was a very big success and went to New York.
A very big success. Yeah. And it's been an interesting journey. My learning curve was very steep because I had not really had any professional experience. The musical that I wrote never got beyond a college production and then sort of skeletal productions. Mm-hmm. And Josh had just suddenly reached the moon. So I had a little trepidation about this. Mm-hmm. But I lived in fear for 3 years, and then it got written.
And you're sleeping a little easier
now.
Yes,
I'm sleeping much easier now.
Well, I don't know if Michael would ever have said to you, but I'd be interested if he did, what it was about your lyrics in that other piece that made him think you'd be good for this project.
He told me that it was their simplicity and their elegance.
Well, that's nice.
Which, that was about the nicest compliment I've ever gotten.
Well, there are a number of things about this project that I think are intriguing and might be interesting to talk about. And maybe we could start with how you deal with an existing piece from another era and a very specific aesthetic, George Bernard Shaw's way of writing, and create new material for it. How do you, Josh, in your case, how do you decide on a musical style that's appropriate for the piece? And Jan, in your case, how do you write new words? Do you try to write them as Shaw would have, or do you start more from fresh? So why don't we start with the music?
I don't believe in the word style. Style is something that people do in New York and in Milan once a year in Fashion Week. And they tell us what we're going to wear for the next year, which I never see, especially because I live in the Midwest and we're a little
above slow. Such things.
We're a little slow to pick up on style.
Uh-huh.
I believe more in terms of constructing, the construction of music by form, structure, the basic building blocks of harmony, rhythm, and then finding ways that I would put them together that would be distinctly me, but that serve a larger purpose, being that of whatever project I'm working on. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It does, but I don't actually buy it completely. Let me tell you what I mean.
You don't buy it.
Okay. Well, because Adding Machine is your work, and I'm sure as much an expression of your voice as this is, and yet the two styles, the idiom, the specific harmonic language, are very different. I mean, Adding Machine is a much more dissonant, much more angular quality of music. If you don't like the word style, then call it quality. This is a much more sort of diatonic, you know, isn't it?
Well, but you're talking about the building blocks of musical material. You're not talking about style.
All right, then call it vocabulary. Is that a better word?
Well, that would be good. The vocabulary of this play is very much rooted, but not exactly aping or imitating, hopefully not, what you would call late Romanticism. In particular, there are these favorite pieces of mine. They're the late Brahms intermezzi. Mm-hmm. And Brahms of his day was an incredible conservatist.
Right.
What he believed in, he believed strongly in terms of rooting whatever discoveries you make as an artist in the past. You need to look at the past before you can move forward. Mm-hmm. And he was very interested in things like counterpoint and layers, that you could, out of very simple ideas, you could create very layered, and especially in those late pieces, very emotionally deep pieces of music. Mm. But you have to start there. That is the period.
Right.
And I don't think that some of these ideas have gone away. I think you have to be faithful. If we decided that this was going to be a production in the 1890s, a period production. But we can look at a relationship, a particular relationship in the 1890s, and then we can also infer the distance between 1890 whatever and 2009 and say, we have changed it, we have not changed at all. Mm-hmm. It adds a power to it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, something really good usually does resonate through its own time.
So if you're asking me, you know, musically, where does that come from? Mm-hmm. Well, it is all the things that I am in the way that I think as a composer, plus who I think had the harder job here, which is Jan, who is only the fourth lyricist and only, I think, the second successful lyricist to grapple with a Shaw play. mm-hmm. and find the lyrics. And the lyrics were, for the most part, written first. And I took the structure of what Jan came up with and what I knew and wanted, what I knew of the vocabulary of the music of 1809, of the late Romantic vocabulary, mm-hmm. plus what I know in between now and there. And we came up with some things.
Well, that's a good transition to Jan.
Thank you. Very nice.
Up there with My Fair Lady, one assumes.
Thank you. And I remember at our first meeting, we were discussing whether we were going to write My Fair Lady, the anti-My Fair Lady. It was all a lot of reference to My Fair Lady, which, you
how
know,
could it not be?
Right,
a
exactly.
Of
it shouldn't be.
But it's in everybody's mind going in. I don't think it is coming out.
Right.
Well, Jan, so what were the challenges for you specifically in taking on this existing play, which, by the way, we should say was adapted and substantially adapted by Austin Pendleton for the book.
Right.
And then your job was to fill in the lyrics.
Well, it turned out that the biggest challenge for me was the character of Candida, because she was a little bit of an enigma. And Shaw gave us some stage directions. He gave us some dialogue. But Austin, Michael, Josh, and I talked quite a bit about whether she was manipulative. And I can't say I knew exactly who Candida was until we actually had Kate Fry singing her.
Mm-hmm.
But that was more challenging to me than even the lyrics. The lyrics, I had a lot of wonderful Shavian text to lift into song, so I could just expand it, have fun with it, and just so I stayed within his language mm-hmm. and within the character of each character, the language of each character. You know, and probably I'm forgetting what hard work it was.
Right. Can't you remember that night when you couldn't
right,
sleep because
right,
you didn't have
right.
a clue how you were going to?
Right, exactly. Exactly. But it felt like in getting to the character of Candida, I had to do the most searching in terms of my own marriage. And it was an interesting journey. And we had a lot of fascinating conversations.
Well, how much of the lyrics does come straight out of Shaw and how much of it is you?
Gosh.
I mean, just a, you know,
what do you
approximation.
Think?
Well, the reason I think it's difficult that you know, this people's, you know, has Lerner and Lowe struggled with this is because he writes verbose, dense,
Shaw is very, mm-hmm.
layered mm-hmm. text.
Mm-hmm.
And while there is quite a bit of it there, it's not like he didn't put it there for a reason.
Right. So if you're going to take stuff out, things start
one
falling
word,
down.
One word yeah. can eliminate 15 tangents mm-hmm. of thought, mm-hmm. but in the words, in the argument, he's does everything. And this play is... Somebody asked Shaw, what is this play about? And he said, nothing. I might be paraphrasing that. I probably am. The mail will roll into your
right,
office.
Right.
No, this play was originally entitled it Candida, a Mystery.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting point. Jan and I were talking before the interview about one of the particular numbers, Enchantment, and... one of the problems that she mentioned. Well, let's set that up a little better and talk about that, because I'd actually like to play that too. So this is the fourth number in the show, and it's the first song, Once Candida, who is, I won't say the main character necessarily, but certainly the center, the epicenter of the action, mm-hmm. First comes on, right? Mm-hmm. And so, Jan, tell me what you said before about the problem you faced with her.
Well, usually when a main character comes on, they sing what they used to call an I want number. They somehow express who they are. And with Candida, because it's a mystery, Shaw has her enter and exit pretty quickly. But Josh came up with the brilliant idea of taking the stage directions that described Candida and turning it into a song where we would feel musically her entrance, something to embody her spirit, even though she would soon leave the room. And that song was the truest of all of our collaborations. It took us forever to get it right. Mm. Because after Josh came up with the music, which never changed after that, we had to decide which words to lift and who would sing them. For a long time, we had Candida singing The Means to an End, Enchantment, as a woman's best friend.
Let's play it now and then keep talking about it.
James Eugene was going to give the cabman 10 shillings.
Oh, never mind her, Marchbank. The overpaying instinct is generous, better than the underpaying one.
No, cowardice, incompetence. Mrs. Morell's quite right.
Of course she is. And now, Eugene, I must leave you with James. Give me my rug. And now hang my cloak across my arm. And now my hat. Thanks. The enchantment.
Oh, the enchantment.
What marvel of courage and strength.
The essence of dignity. Oh, the enchantment.
Oh, the enchantment. Engaging affection. Providing attention. A means to an end. Yes. Enchantment is truly
the enchantment.
Enchantment is truly
So pick up what you were saying.
Okay, so lyrics. That led to a long discussion about Candida, whether she was actually manipulative or if she was just a caretaker, and it seemed like a really important point to make. And the problem was solved by giving those lines to Prossy,
the other
female character, which also added... It underlined the fact that she is jealous in some ways of Candida. Mm-hmm. So it turned it into a much more interesting musical scene. But to make this short little scene, Austin had to rewrite for 3 months to make it clean and to have the action exhibit what the words and the music were saying. Mm-hmm. And Michael had no small part in cracking the whip on that one. Uh-huh. So it looks like a very simple moment, but it really was a tough one to pull together. Because even though she needed a song, but we couldn't really give her one.
She needed a song that didn't tell us anything about
exactly,
her.
Exactly.
Well, the Shaw sets this... there's 2 points to be made here. This... Specifically to this moment, Shaw sets up expositionally this huge, big brouhaha. Oh, she's coming home.
She's coming. There's a fair amount of suspense. We're waiting for Candida to come for a while.
I don't know if it's suspense, but I mean, it's almost overbearing. And then she comes in, she does a few things, and she gets out.
Right.
And
she flits by.
And it's anticlimactic. Mm-hmm. And he deliberately... does that. Mm-hmm. Now, as in the adaptation, you know, we don't have to be faithful to that. She could have sang.
Or you could have not had a song at all.
In which you would have then had 5 pages of text. Mm-hmm. I know, because I looked at 5 pages of text and said, you cannot go 5 pages
there
of text.
There is a song.
Right.
And the thing about Candida, she definitely has the effect that just charms the pants off of all these people. Mm-hmm. And in Prossy's case, why do I not have that effect? Mm-hmm.
Well, let me go back to something about Candida and discovering Candida that you said, Jan, which was that you felt like you didn't completely know who she was until you saw Kate Fry be her. That's a very interesting idea to me because when you just put on a play, each actor, I mean, normally, I suppose, when you do the play Candida, the actor who's playing Candida makes a decision for herself about what Candida is and the performances of the other actors, you know, evolve around that. You had to make that decision collaboratively as an artistic team writing the adaptation because it would drive what you kept and what you expanded on. And then to have the actor come in and teach you about that, I think, right, is pretty wonderful. But what did you learn about Candida from watching Kate do it?
I learned that she was much more no-nonsense, business-like, unsentimental.
Straightforward.
Yeah,
that's a good word.
Than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And there was none of the beating around the bush that could have been interpreted in the lyrics.
Mm-hmm. Did you actually revise anything as a result of seeing her differently as in the performance?
No.
Everything fit.
Uh-huh. She just performed it very differently than the way I saw it in my head.
Right.
Well, and it's the same thing when I give lyrics to Josh. It comes back as something totally different.
Right. Let's go to another aspect that I think the Enchantment clip we heard illustrates about the piece that I was interested in. We only heard the last bit of it, and there's dialogue, and then you heard the song. But actually, the entire number, there's dialogue, music, is it twice or three times that it goes back and forth?
I think there's three choruses of Enchantment and then two dialogue.
In between.
And you would, the idea of it being like a rondeau, like a circle, A, B, A, C, A.
Well, what I wanted to talk about that brings up is the transition from text to music, which also the style of music. And what I felt about this was, first of all, there were unexpected transitions between dialogue and music, and just having dialogue come and go in the song is at least somewhat unusual, certainly not unprecedented. But, and the other thing is that maybe related, maybe not, is that a lot of the music felt to me a little bit like the kind of music you write in a show that's sung through, that kind of covers more ground, almost like recitative or something, where you know there's lots of more new ideas and more both musically and in the lyrics over the course of one song than might be conventional of in an, you know, Lerner and Lowe, My Fair Lady. And yet there's also lots of text. It isn't a sung through piece by any means. So I don't know, Josh, if any of that rings true to you or was a conscious choice, or if there's anything good to say about it.
Sure. Originally, when we first met Austin at the bus stop cafe in Abingdon Square, as he was eating something, he mentioned that he would say, "You should just set all of it to music."
Uh-huh.
Right. And I thought, "Oh, I'm out of a job here."
And I assured him that if we did that, we'd be looking at a 5-hour play.
Right.
When you read the play, it's a wall of words. It really is. And doesn't mean it can't be a fascinating experience, but it's a lot of talking. The idea of these people is that regardless of what they say or do, buried beneath them, within their hearts, are a lot of frustrated emotions, or insecurities, or deep-seated conflicts. And the music is that emotion trying to burst through the Shavian text.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the music is always present. And that may be unconventional, and maybe there are ways that if we ever go back to look at it again, we could reshape that to find better points of departure. But the whole idea of this play is that, or this music, of the music, is that nothing ever resolves.
Right.
Like you want it to.
That's true.
Excuse me. Yeah. It's a lot of arguments, and you could turn those into more traditional musical scenes that wrap up, but these arguments are all leading towards a place at the end that doesn't actually resolve, but it would be very artificial to have them all set in a structure as if they were finished thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Actually, all the songs pretty much end. The enchantment ends on a very unresolved chord.
Right.
Shy, shy, shy leads us up to a cadence, and it's an unresolved cadence.
Right, we get the dominant, get our tonic.
At the end, at the end, basically, so.
Right.
Tell me.
Right.
That's what it brings you up to. Candida's song could go on forever, but she stops herself because what's happening, this is spoiled from the cradle. She stops herself before, because if she goes any further, probably more things will come out of her mouth that she can't take back.
Mm-hmm. Than she's willing to risk.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jan, you said that not only did most of the songs not resolve harmonically, but that you would, and in many cases, you had written a last, the next rhyme or something, and Josh would say, okay, we're getting rid of that line, because that's the, tie it up neatly approach, and that's not what we're doing.
And he wouldn't actually tell me. It would be when I heard it or when I got the next email, I would just notice that it was missing.
Uh-huh.
So I think part of Josh's challenge with working with me is I'm 20 years older than he is, and I was raised on A Chorus Line, My Fair Lady, Carousel, and those are really the song structures that I knew and had studied. And I remember telling Josh, I learned from my lyric writing teacher there are three song forms. And he's probably still laughing.
Oh, I never laughed. I don't know what they are.
Right. I never laughed.
Well, but it's interesting because, some people who are coming in, I guess, expecting My Fair Lady need to realize that when the golden age of the book musical dawned on us, though they were trying to create a fully formed dramatic experience in the theater. And of its time, it's very innovative.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but it had, and I guess it's not like I'm rebelling against it. I'm just saying that if I can get to a point where I can predict it, I'm not interested anymore.
Right.
If it's only there to satisfy my expectations, I don't care.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so well put.
Well, we are out of time, but this was a fascinating conversation, and I thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of June 22nd, 2009. Chicago Shakespeare Theater brings an enchanting adaptation of the 1992 Disney animated film Aladdin to the stage. The production features Alan Menken's, Howard Ashman's, and Tim Rice's award-winning songs, including A Whole New World and A Friend Like Me. The show stars Larry Yando and Derek Hasenstab, who will reunite as a diabolical duo, Jafar and Iago. Immediately following each performance, the actors will join the audience for conversations and photo opportunities in the lobby. Aladdin is the story of a clever street urchin who discovers a magical lamp, a fun-loving genie, and his love for a beautiful princess, all inside of three wishes. The show features a timeless message of friendship and the importance of staying true to oneself. Disney's Aladdin is recommended for ages 5 and up. Performances start on July 1st in the Courtyard Theater, and yes, tickets are available. To find out how to get those tickets, click on over to Theater in Chicago's Theater News section. Steep Theatre Company closes its historic 2008-2009 season with a bang, with the Midwest premiere of Howard Korder's The Hollowlands, an ambitious 14-actor and 30-character historical epic. Steep's special blend of grit, edge, and ensemble work comes to life in this story about America's early pioneers, and the traces of our nation's journey towards its manifest destiny and the trail it leaves behind. Howard Korder is best known for his plays Search and Destroy, The Lights, and Boy's Life, for which he was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Steep is also pleased to announce that Korder will be coming here to Chicago to take part in the rehearsal process. The production features a stellar cast, including Jonathan Edwards, Cynthia Marker, Brendan Melanson, along with many others in Steep's celebrated ensemble. The Hollowlands begin this Thursday, June 25th, and run through August 1st. Tickets are available. To find out how to get those tickets, follow the links on theaterinchicago.com. Benno Nelson brings Theater in Chicago News another interview. This one is featuring Nick Diamond, the current artistic director of Straw Dog Theater, and how back in 1993 he offered his services as set designer and changed the course of the company. It's a very good article, so check it out. It's at Theater in Chicago News. Go there now. Theater in Chicago has now joined the Twitter sphere. That's right, we have our own profile on Twitter. You can follow us at twitter.com/TheaterChicago. Again, that's twitter.com/TheaterChicago. Or if you're a current Twitter user, that's at Theater Chicago. Check out our Twitter feed to be up to date on the latest tweets, news. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank our guest for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Ann Nicholson Weber and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And I would also like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.